Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. You just heard the title track of Jesse Ryan's Juno-nominated debut album, Bridges, called Big Ol' Shoes, featuring the Mount Tamarind Band. Jesse Ryan's a Trinidadian-born saxophonist based in Toronto, who blends modern jazz and Afro-Caribbean musical tradition through his original compositions, and he also runs a podcast dedicated to having conversations with award-winning saxophonists from around the world. Before the interview, we'll check out John Gordon's arrangement of the Monk tune Evidence from his 92 album, The John Gordon Quartet, and two more tracks from Bridges called Right to Be Wrong and Seeds. Thank you.
If I stumble, will you offer me your hand? And if I fall, will you lend me your legs? If my soul drowns in darkness, will you cover me with light? And does your love grant me the right to be wrong? Will you stand with me through strife? Does your love cover? Yes, love covers. Love covers a multitude of wrongs. Thank you.
Joining us is Jesse Ryan, a Trinidadian-born saxophonist based in Toronto. He blends modern jazz and Afro-Caribbean musical tradition through his original compositions, and his debut album, Bridges, got nominated for a Juno. He studied with musicians such as John Gordon and Kirk McDonald, and also runs a podcast dedicated to having conversations with on-demand and award-winning saxophonists from around the world. How are you doing, Jesse?
I'm good. How are you, Garrett?
Pretty good.
Good, good, good.
I guess the first question is, what got you into jazz?
Ooh, that's a good one. So when I was 10 years old, my aunt bought me a Walkman. I'm not sure. Do you know what a Walkman is, Garrett?
Yeah, I know what a Walkman is. Yeah.
Good, good, good. Some Gen Zers may not know what a Walkman is. But yeah, when I was 10 years old, I got a Walkman for my birthday. And I started listening to just radio. And I discovered this radio station. I don't think it was a Trinidadian radio station. I think I was picking it up from maybe one of the close islands. Because I just never heard anything like that before. Anyway, so they were playing something. I remember there being singing, and I remember being sort of like a Broadway-ish sort of jazz song. And that was like the first moment that kind of piqued my attention, or my interest rather. When I went to high school, my music teacher at the time, Michelle Huggins Watts, she's an award-winning steel pan arranger. And she introduced us to all types of music, you know, and jazz one of them. And I think it was the connections between, you know, calypso and Afro-Caribbean traditions, and those connections to jazz that really kind of drew me in.
Definitely, yeah. Because, like, I guess my mom's side of the family, she's from Tobago.
So, like, amazing.
Like, know what you're talking about with all, like, the calypso and the steel pan stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess to lead into that, your Juno nominated album Bridges is kind of a blend of modern jazz and Caribbean influences. So yeah. What was your approach to combining the two together?
Well, that's a good question. So I was writing a lot of this music, you know, even before I moved to Toronto. Still very much seeds of it, but that was kind of like my artistic direction. And so as I was learning more about jazz and about, you know, modern harmony and this ensemble concepts and all of that, I was trying to find something that could sort of ground center what I was doing, and at the same time I was trying to also pursue some ancestral DNA at the same time. So that kind of led me to and I'm not exactly sure, you know, actually no, I remember now. So there's one of my favorite saxophonists is Miguel Zenon. And he has an album called Esta Plena, or This Is Plena. And so he very much does something similar where he's taking folk tradition of plena music and fusing it with, you know, modern jazz. And so the drums and the plena music really captivated me. And then I realized, oh, wait, no, there's a tradition like this on the island of Grenada where my grandfather, Clifton Ryan, Mighty Bummer, that's where he's from. Or I should say that's where he was from, because he passed away just at the beginning of this year. But made the connection, oh, there's a tradition like this very similar on the island of Tobago called tambourine music. And so that kind of sent me down the path of researching tambourine music, and I really fell in love with the music. So because most of the music was already written, or I had already began written it, the tambourine music kind of became an extra layer to the music. And so I had to rewrite and sort of rework some of the grooves and even some of the, like, the harmonic rhythm to fit the tambourine, or to accommodate this extra layer of music. So that was kind of part of the compositional approach. Artistically though, I was trying to be as authentic and as honest as possible in terms of where I was at the time and the kind of influences and sounds I was trying to assimilate into my own personal voice, and just try to write a tune that might express some of those things. So
yeah, to kind of blend it honestly, like have a really clear, like defining, like structure, I guess.
Absolutely, man. And I think that album for me was very much a project, you know. There's a lot of research went into tambourine music, but then also it's my first album, and it really helped me to learn about producing an album, and all the elements, all the production elements that are integral into taking, you know, going from ideation to bringing it to the band, rehearsing it, performing it, then going into studio, and all of those stages of producing a record. So there was a lot of learning going on during that process.
Yeah, definitely. Because I also noticed you had like a tambourine band as well, like on your tracks.
So yeah, was, yeah.
The layers you were talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. So I traveled back home in I think it was June of 2019, and I went over to the island of Tobago. And I spent a day with the Mount Kulin Tambourine Band. And we, the first half of the day, we just kind of hung out a little bit, talked about the tradition. They played me all the different rhythms and talked about the cultural significance of each rhythm and the history of the music. And then we spent the later part of the afternoon into evening recording tambourine on three of the tracks, which ended up on the album.
Yeah. I guess, like, how would you define, like, Caribbean music? How would you say, like, if you were going to say, like, to somebody, oh, I would, like, say you should, like, add some, like, Caribbean rhythms or, like, African-Caribbean rhythms, how do you kind of combine that in there without it feeling kind of, like, kitschy, I guess?
When you say kitschy, what do you mean by that?
Like, you know the whole, like, Afro-Cuban thing where it's like, oh, there's a night in Tunisia or there's a girl from Ipanema and it's, like, mm-hmm. an elevator music thing. How do you make it sound, like, honest? Like, it fits into the thing. Like, it's a part of...
Well, I mean, I think you have to endeavor to really understand where the music is coming from. It's definitely coming from, you know, the continent, Africa. Mm. And understanding those roots. So, like, a song like the song Bridges on my album, that's very much... Like, I spent a big chunk of time trying to figure out, okay, what is this rhythm? What's the vibe of this thing? And so it's very much a West African big three rhythm, a three pulse rhythm that it's like a three against four kind of thing that you can hear it in four, you can hear it in six or three or however you hear it. So I would say dig deep into the roots of the music and really understand where it's coming from. You know, in a band like mine, the hardest chair to have is the drum chair, because there's so much that the drummer has to know and assimilate to be able to play this music. And I think as a composer, if you're intending to merge Afro-Caribbean and jazz music, I mean, I think it's one continuum, to be honest, because I think there's so many there's so much interpolation that happened, you know, let's say in the 1950s, 60s between calypsonians and jazz musicians. You know, so Kitchener, you know, one of the most well-known calypsonians, you know, he was a jazz bassist, right? So he was bringing some of those influences into his music, and I know that jazz musicians were also listening to that stuff. And there was this big sort of celebration of different cultural influences, you know, with Afro-Cuban jazz, you know, happening in the 60s in New York and all of that. So I think it's one continuum, yes, but if you're a band leader and you're a composer and you're writing music with that artistic intention, choosing the right musicians is really important as well.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, like, to go on the other side of the pendulum, you studied with, like, John Gordon, Louis Denise, and, like, Kirk McDonald. So, like, how have all your numerous mentors, like, helped you to create, like, the Jesse Ryan sound? Like, where, like, what's your, like, influences for the saxophone part of?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for the most part, I'm beginning to realize that I do have an approach. I do have a sound that people can recognize. But at the same time, I'm very much still in pursuit of defining what that thing is. Needless to say, I think, you know, had the opportunity to study with, you know, Louis Dennis for like my, I think we did at least 1 year when I was at Humber College. You know, he's from Cuba and he has a really deep understanding of, you know, Afro-Cuban music and the roots of the music, but then also he's been mentored by some of, the greats in jazz as well, so and he is completely enamored by Charlie Parker. So having had that experience, he was able to bring both perspectives. He's still very much a dear friend and mentor to me. So I continue to lean on, on my mentors for advice about developing technically, developing a personal sound. I mean, in terms of developing a personal song, I think John Gordon has helped me a lot with that. I studied with him last year. And again, he's still a, very, very, very good friend and mentor. I think in terms of influences, Kenny Garrett has been a huge influence for me. I don't think I've necessarily, I definitely, I don't necessarily endeavor to sound like him, but
Right.
I know that some of his inflections, and just the soulfulness of his playing has kind of influenced, how I hear music for sure. Somebody like Miguel Zenon has been a huge influence artistically, and even just like developing sound on the saxophone. I would describe my sound as more of a warm, darker sound, compared to like the classic, New York alto sound. And so I think some of that is coming from, listening to Miguel and being influenced by that approach. And I'm not claiming that I sound in any way like these guys, but definitely their approach has influenced mine. There's tons of other players too, but I think finding a personal sound is always an amalgamation of, many different things while working on fundamentals at the same time.
Definitely, yeah. It's like
Yeah.
jigsaw pieces, and then like what John says about being like a stylist, you kind of have to figure out like
Exactly.
those kind of things as you go along.
Yeah, and I love the way that John talks about being a stylist, because
Oh yeah.
when I did my first year of my undergrad at Berklee College of Music, and I remember doing a course on, like, I think it was called Survey of Woodwind Styles or something like that was the name of the course. And one of the modules on the course was, becoming a stylist or stylist. And stylist had almost like a binary sort of meaning to it, where you were not this, but you were that, right? And that was like a stylist. But the way that John uses it, it's more of an open thing. It's more about developing a personal sound, working on fundamentals in a way that it allows you to have a strong foundation, but you personalize those elements to be in alignment with, your musical identity, your cultural identity, how you hear music, so yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I also saw that you have like a saxophone podcast called Keep Ta Taking Ground.
Yes.
So how is like interviewing all those saxophonists deepened your understanding of the instrument and the players?
Well, I think it's definitely given me different perspectives, and it's really humbling and really a blessing to be able to connect with, these award-winning and in-demand musicians. I think so on episode one of season one of the podcast, I think that's probably been the most popular episode so far. Podcast is still very much, emerging, but I had Melissa Aldana on, saxophonist from Chile. And the title of her episode was, Managing Your Ego is the Key to Musical Development. And she shared a story about, how going into jams and sitting jazz jams and clubs was very intimidating for her, being English as a second language, all of the challenges of leaving your home country and coming to a new place and all of that. Very could be very intimidating and daunting, but she had to face that. And then, but the ego says, the ego wants to run away from those challenges, because you become aware of your inadequacies, you become aware of your all the things you need to work on, and The ego tries to protect you from that. But the key to actually developing is to managing that ego and confronting those things that you have to confront to develop, even in the practice room. You know, I find that that's where the ego could be the loudest at times. You know, yeah. When you're away from everybody in the practice room, you're working on something, and you know you're sounding really crappy, but you have to be patient and you just have to work through it. And so that's been really helpful. That I mean, among other things, I've had the first episode, you know, featured 10 different conversations between like 30 minutes to an hour, you know. So it's been great so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess to pivot to a different thing, your newest single, The Night Before She Passed, is dedicated to your late mother who passed away from cancer. Mm-hmm. So how did you go about like conveying that feeling like in your music?
Well, first of all, when I wrote the song, it was to create a space where I could express and process my own feelings, because I had so many things bouncing around my head. Of course, there's a great sense of loss. There's grief. You know, when I didn't have the opportunity to travel back home to Trinidad before she passed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you lose a loved one and you're not able to be there, and I've talked to a couple of people about this, and we all agree that there's sometimes a sense of guilt that surrounds that. And then there's a sense of just like numbness that happens because there's so much that you're trying to process. So I was trying to convey all of those emotions and use, you know, different elements of music to do that. So when you listen to the piano intro, it's very much a little bit melancholic and reflective. Once the melody comes in, it's more buoyant and hopeful. And that was intentional because I didn't want to write just like a melancholic ballad. I wanted the listener to still experience hope and feel the juxtaposition of all of that. For example, when you go into the B section, the groove is a little bit more up tempo, but there's this sense of like forward motion, but yet still tension building into like the C section. So all of that is really intentional. You know, I'm trying to, when I'm writing music, I try to distill my thoughts and ideas into like key, like one word, one main word. And then I think, how can I actually communicate this through music? And I think that comes also from like my understanding of branding, because I also do graphic design and branding on the side. And that's something I kind of got into, by the way, because I was actually doing visual art. I fell in love with visual art before I fell in love with music, you know. But I think that experience also influences how I write, because I've spent a fair bit of time trying to figure out how to communicate effectively, whether that's through writing and storytelling. I have a YouTube playlist that's called Storytelling, and I want to learn how to tell stories, because as musicians, that's what we do, right? So storytelling and then I'm constantly trying to think, okay, how can I communicate, you know, hope? How can I communicate sadness? That's probably an easier one, or more generic one, but how do I communicate apathy? You know, so I'm constantly trying to do that, and that's how I approached writing the song.
Yeah, I definitely relate to what you were saying like earlier, because like my dad, he like passed away from cancer like in June.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a big part of my life. Like he got me into music, and like I couldn't have done all this like stuff without him. And like I know exactly what you're feeling about the numbness and loss and.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, it's a really tough feeling to convey to somebody, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you haven't experienced losing a close loved one,
yeah.
it's something that's it's also really hard to put into words. And I found myself, well, I mean, I think I'm still really processing it. My mom passed away 5 years ago, and I still have moments of like deep grief, and I find that I've processed it in waves.
Definitely.
I don't ever try to force myself to process it though. I just kind of allow the emotions to flow in and out like a tide, and just kind of be open to when it happens and create space for it. There are times when I need to take time and just like have downtime, and there are times when I'm fine, and I can just kind of keep pushing on. So it's definitely a process, and one of the things I'm really passionate about from that experience is talking to people about this, because I realize that there is some sense of comfort that comes from talking about this. It may not necessarily help with the grief, but I think part of the grief process is also finding connection through understanding with others helps to deal with the disconnection of losing a loved one. So I found that really helpful, and that's kind of what I'm intending to do with the new single. I think I can share this here. I'm about to launch a campaign with the Princess Margaret Cancer Foundation, with the release of the music video of for the song, which is coming out pretty soon. And the intention is to is a sort of a DIY campaign to raise funds to support the work that they're doing, but then also just create awareness around, losing a loved one, and make people aware, especially people of color and people from from the Caribbean, know that it's okay to access things like grief counseling, because it's a lot to process.
Yeah, that's a great thing you're doing because like grief is something that people don't really understand until it happens to you. Like that's just how it is, and like when you try to talk to somebody, like they can't get it. So the fact that you're doing that is really good, and the fact that you can convey that through music, like your experience through grief, that's
Yeah, man. And well, the
really
other side
powerful.
of that too is that we don't talk about death.
Yeah, we don't.
We talk about a child being born and celebrating the first steps and going to college and getting married and buying the house and getting the new car and celebrating the time, with that we ha actually have with loved ones. But we rarely ever talk about what life is when you lose a loved one. How do you prepare to lose a loved one? Or just the reality that, hey, we someday everyone we know is gonna die, or we ourselves, we have to come to grasp with that. And I think one of the lessons that I've learned out of my mom's passing is that life is short, and we have to make the best of the opportunities we have. And there are two principles that kind of help guide me. Now, the first one is, in 100 years, nobody's gonna remember your name. However, don't underestimate the value of your presence right now.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what you just said. Like, you nailed it.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, the sooner I guess people like just talk about death and grief and just kind of access like that part of life. Like, I mean, it's a hard journey. People won't really understand until it happens to them, but you have to try.
Yeah. If there's anybody listening right now, I would say find some way to begin thinking about death. Find some way to sit with the reality that tomorrow is not guaranteed. And I find that one of the most liberating things ever. Some people find it morbid and depressing. I find it liberating.
Yeah, 'cause
Because it's
you kind of have to live with that to kind of really move, to really live, like to understand life. You have to, you can't run from it. You have to accept it. Makes sense, yeah.
absolutely. And I think artists in particular are really poised to talk about this because we are constantly living on the edge of our ability. We're constantly trying to do better. And to do that, it sometimes feels as look standing on the edge of a cliff and looking over into like that dark abyss of chaos and trying to find a way to organize it and then create a narrative and a story, and then we can share that with people. That's what creativity feels like. Trying to create something out of nothing, you know? And I know that might be an abstract concept, but artists, musicians, composers, creatives, we understand that so intimately. And even though we may not be able to articulate it, so I think I'm happy that I became aware of it. I mean, through an unfortunate experience of losing my mom, but I feel like if it's become part of my, I don't want to get too sentimental, but part of my mission to continue to encourage other people to process and grief and loss in a healthy way, while I do the same, I think it's a two-way street.
Definitely, because we continue to change and grow as people, and then when you go through death, you're not the same person, but you have to go
No.
forward.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks. That was great. Thanks again for the interview.
Thanks to Jesse Ryan for being here on the show. What you heard before the interview was Big Ol' Shoes from Bridges, John Gordon playing Evidence from the John Gordon Quartet, Right to Be Wrong and Seeds also from Bridges. We'll finish off with The Night Before She Passed, a new single that Jesse Ryan dedicated to his mother, who passed away from cancer. It was good getting to talk to somebody who's had a similar experience to me. You don't find those opportunities very often. This is Canadian Sweet signing off.